It's One-on-One. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're back for another coffeehouse conversation, this week with Reverend Norm Elliott, who is an Episcopal priest of such amazing duration in Anchorage that you must have beat everybody else in terms of longevity. You're 93 years old now?
Yes, as of February.
All right, and you've been here since 1951, you said?
July of 51.
And you were saying that one of your first jobs, when you came, you were a deacon, right?
That's right.
And then you came to Anchorage, but then you were pretty soon out into Nunana and some of the more remote areas of Alaska.
Well, I came to Alaska to Nunana, St. Mark's Mission.
Oh,
Nunana.
You went straight to Nunana. Okay.
And then in the Episcopal Church, you have to be a deacon, as it's called, for at least 6 months, preferably for a year. And so in February of 52, that's when I became a priest.
Okay.
I was still serving at Nunana, but then I learned to fly at Merrill Field in 52, and that's when I went off to the villages along the Yukon.
And now, people may not know just how remote Alaska was in the early 1950s. Nunana, you couldn't drive there, right?
No, in fact, the only way out of Nunana or into Nunana was by train, and those were steam locomotives in those days, or by small plane, and in the summer by boat.
Right.
But that's the only way you could get to Fairbanks, and as far as Minto, which many of the people were related to Minto, the only way to get there was to fly or to take the boat in the summer.
Uh-huh.
So we were pretty isolated, and of course it was a smaller community anyway.
Right. And now, Bishop Gordon, who most people probably don't know who that was, but he was a pretty important figure in Alaska in the early days in terms of his flying all around the country, and I've heard he's just an amazing personality. Was he? Mm-hmm. Was he sort of the person you were working for? And
well, in a sense, yes. I was, you might say, directly under him as, first of all, was called diocesan missioner, and then later that was named Archdeacon of the Yukon, which happens to be one of the great titles because the first man to climb Mount McKinley was Archdeacon of the Yukon, Hudson Stuck.
And he was the Episcopal priest who traveled Alaska on a dog sled, and he wrote 10,000 miles on a dog sled.
10,000 miles, and then also, of course, his summer voyages on the Yukon and its tributaries. Mm-hmm. He also traveled by boat, but no, his best book is 10,000 Miles mm-hmm. with a Dog Team.
And he was a pretty important figure in Alaska history because he spread the word outside Alaska of the way the natives were being abused by the gold rush stampeders, and the fact that there needed to be some stepping in and supporting mm-hmm. native mm-hmm. people who were being starved, essentially, because their fish were being taken. And
mm-hmm. So, but mainly he was concerned with the retaining of native customs mm-hmm. and well, that comes out in his books.
So right.
You see.
So Bishop Gordon kind of comes in that tradition a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. He was the third bishop of Alaska. There was Bishop Rowe. Peter Trimble Rowe was the first, followed by Bentley, John Bentley, and then Gordon.
I see.
And but he was the first one to fly. Actually, Rove traveled by dog team if he was traveling, in addition to the flying. And Bentley was known as the riverboat man because he was so famous for his ability to travel the many, many rivers of Alaska. In fact, he had a boat called the Pelican, which he named after a verse in the psalm, like a pelican in the wilderness. And then Bishop Gordon started off with the boat, the Godspeed, but decided that it would be better to fly, and so that's when the diocesan office, you call it that, or the headquarters, it had been in, well, Bishop Rowe had it in Seattle, strangely enough, for in his last years. It was originally in Sitka.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bentley moved it to Nunana because that was where he could launch his boat.
Mm-hmm.
And Bishop Gordon decided flying, he established it in Fairbanks, and that's where it's been ever since.
And so, Bishop Gordon, did he already know how to fly, or did he just look at the situation?
No, he learned to fly.
Learned to fly, and got to the church, had an airplane, and so then he would just fly all around Alaska, bringing gospel to different tiny villages.
That's right. Yeah, but he learned to fly after he became bishop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And was that part of his philosophy of like being personally there for people?
Oh, I suppose so. It was one way to get to the villages in winter and summer, mm-hmm. and that was important. And in those days, we had fewer clergy in Alaska. So the only time they could have a service was when someone got there, and that's why I had seven villages from Eagle on the Yukon River at the border down to Tananaw and north to Arctic Village in the Brooks Range. Mm-hmm. And the only time they would have a service was when I got there. And so the same thing with Bishop Gordon. Mm-hmm. But nowadays we've increased our native clergy, which we didn't have in those days. And so the need to fly to those villages to have services has gone down quite a bit.
Right. Well, and I suppose you could just get on a air taxi and zoom out there. You don't actually have to be able to fly yourself.
Right. And in fact, right now it's been determined that it's cheaper, strange as it may seem, to fly commercially mm-hmm. than it is to fly your own plane. When you think of the maintenance of the required checking and so forth mm-hmm. and all that, plus the fuel, it's cheaper to fly mm-hmm. commercially.
So you arrive in Alaska, and one of your first jobs is to learn how to fly an airplane.
Well, I suppose
close to,
so.
Right?
I was never good with a dog team, so.
All right. And that, where were you coming from? I mean, was that certainly was a bit of a culture shock.
Well, it was in a sense that the reason I happened to come, and I think that's important, is that the National Church appoints missionaries, as they're called. And so one day, the man from New York, where the national headquarters came, and said, where do you want to go? Because I had been given permission by my bishop in Michigan to go. I didn't mm-hmm. have to go return to Michigan. I said, India. He said, we have no openings in India. We have one in the Philippines. I said, all right, sounds good. What's the job like? He said, I don't know. You better write to the bishop of the Philippines to find out. So I did. Well, in the meantime, Bishop Gordon came to the seminary and said, I hear that you're looking for a job, and I'd like you to come to Alaska, and here's what I want you to do. So he explained that he eventually wanted me to take over learning to fly and so forth and go to the villages. Well, I kept waiting and waiting to hear from the bishop of the Philippines, and one day the man from New York came and said, I've got to know right now where you're going, because we're not going to make another appointment for 6 months, and you'll go back to Michigan for 6 months. So I said, well, I haven't heard from the bishop of the Philippines, so it's Alaska. Well, I found out much later that the bishop of the Philippines had written to me, but his secretary had sent it surface mail instead of air mail. So I didn't get it. Otherwise, I may have gone to the
So the letter was on a slow boat going across the Pacific.
Right, and the first winter in Nenana was 50 below, and I thought, why didn't I choose the Philippines?
You should have waited for the Philippines, right. Huh? Wow. So that's our good luck, I guess, that you...
Well, I don't know about good luck for you, but anyway, it's been a good time for me.
So you showed up and had to learn to fly a plane. Is that something you'd ever wanted to do before, or...
Never
just,
thought of
just
it.
Just a way of doing the job?
Never thought of it.
Were you a pretty good pilot?
Well, that depends on who you ask. I had a little yellow plane. Of course, Pipers are yellow. And... it became known as the Drunken Canary. But I think that testifies to my skill as a pilot.
Well, did you crash?
I only had one crash, which was when I was flying on a beautiful day in June. I can even tell you the date, June the 13th, which happened on a Thursday, not a Friday. And I was flying a doctor and a nurse from Venati, where I had taken them, back to Fort Yukon, which is only a 45-minute run. And all of a sudden, the canvas ripped off the top of the plane, right from the windscreen itself all the way back to the tail. And I could hear it flapping. And so I said to...
So when you say, then that's like the skin of the plane.
That's right. The whole top came right off.
So you're looking up and you can see the sky?
That's right. You see the sky and hear it flapping. Now, if I hadn't heard it flapping, I may have tried to gone into Fort Yukon, only 21 miles. I think I could have made it. but I was concerned that the tail, the ripped off fabric might wrap around the fuselage, the tail, and that would have finished us right mm-hmm. then, no control at all. And so I said, well, there's two things. One, I can try to get to Fort Yukon, or I can try and get this thing down. So they said, look, you're the pilot, you do what you have to. So I did, we landed in the tundra and we had small wheels. Otherwise we would have been fine. But with the small wheels, just as we came to almost a stop, the wheels sank in and we turned upside down. Mm-hmm. And I knew we were on the flight plan, and I kept waiting for someone to come and get us. Like, we could hear planes.
So everybody was okay?
Well, everyone was all right. But I wondered why no one was spotting us, because as I said, we had filed a flight plan and we were right on the flight line. And I could hear planes. Well, they thought I was landing on may have landed on a sandbar. Mm-hmm. So they were searching the river and didn't spot us. And the ironic part of it was that the mail plane came over from Vinatai and he flew directly over us. So by looking out to the left or the right, he couldn't see us. We were directly below him. And so finally, a huge plane from Elmendorf spotted us and dropped the parachute, a container. Well, first of all, they dropped a radio with a parachute and asked if I needed any medical help, and I said, no, we're fine, but do give us some netting. We have mosquito dope, but the mosquitoes are by the billion down here.
Oh, I'm sure.
Netting would help. And so whoever was the pilot said, well, we'll drop you a whole container. So we dropped the container. When I opened it up, the first thing I pulled out was a carbine. Rifle.
So you could shoot the mosquitoes.
I radioed it up and I said, they're not this big yet. And then later they came with a helicopter and pulled us out. So that was my only accident, yes.
Well, that wasn't your fault. That wasn't your fault.
Not really my fault, although I think I got blamed for not having it fully inspected or something or other.
Oh, I see. Well, it's your fault for the plane falling apart.
That's right.
Right. But you didn't go out and buy the plane.
No. It belonged to the diocese. The missionary district as it was in those days.
Now, you mentioned arriving in Nenana in 50 degrees below zero. Operating a plane in that kind of weather is not that simple either.
Well, I never would fly at 50 below. I have flown at 40. But the thing about flying small planes is that when you land at 40 below, you drain the oil immediately before it becomes too thick to even drain. And we had a special little container in which we poured the oil in, and we had two plumber's fire pots. And when you went to take off again, you dropped a big canvas over the hood of the engine, and there was a sock for the prop. And you put one fire pot underneath that canvas tent to heat the engine, and then you had another one boiling your oil. And so you would stand around and you would say, well, I think that's hot enough. Rip off the canvas, pour in the oil, snuff out your container, stick them in the plane and jump in and hope that before it froze up again, you could take off.
Right.
And you had to hand prop in those days, even though you had a self-starter.
Why is that? You mean
to do that. And it was always worrisome because you were on skis.
Oh, yeah.
And when you did this and your head went down, the plane could jump forward, and the next thing you would be headless, you know, if you got caught in the prop. But fortunately, I never did, so.
Well, you must have been a pretty adventurous soul, because everything you're telling me is adventurous and not sort of the retiring Episcopal priest. Was it fun?
Yes and no. Now, I'll be quite frank. It was not fun in the wintertime. You never knew. In fact, in those days, you know, even though I had a radio, which rarely worked, I have to say that, there was no way to radio ahead to a village and say, what's the weather? Mm. And if you ran into fog or something, the best thing to do was to get down as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Because you never knew what would and I made it a point of never flying into clouds because, well, as some people have later learned, there could be a mountain mm-hmm. in the cloud.
Well, and there's the villages, there's no phone in the village either, right?
There were no phones in those. Well, there were phones. Put it this way. There were hand crank phones at Fort Yukon. But the only real contact outside of Fort Yukon was by Wien radio, mm-hmm. the Air Force, the airline.
And, Wien airline?
Wien Airline.
So as they're flying over, they'd radio out to the village?
Well, yes, they could radio down because there was an a CAA station in those days. And there's a wonderful story about one of the great pilots, Fred Goodwin, who radioed ahead and said, turn on the light at the airport. And the reply was, it's on. Well, it wasn't. And so he kept saying, will you turn on the light? It's not on. It is on. So finally he came on, twinkle, twinkle, little star, O Fort Yukon, where you are. But he made it in.
I'm talking today with the Reverend Norm Elliott, who has been in Alaska for well over 60 years. He is, I have to say, 93 years old. It's okay to talk about your age at this age,
right? Oh, it's all right.
And Episcopal priest who has had a lot of adventures in bringing his faith to villages across the state, and also many, many years in Anchorage. And I'm just honored to have you here today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, it must have been quite an exciting thing in the village to have a priest show up when essentially the village is cut off from the outside world, and mm-hmm. it's very much a subsistence society out there. It's not much like it is today, where people have TVs and internet and radio and everything. They're sort of are you bringing the news from the outside world as well as bringing a service?
Oh, no, because they had school radios.
Okay.
And also Tundra Topics from Fairbanks, which would help. If we wanted to send a message or receive a message, everyone would listen to Tundra Topics at a certain time every night.
I see. So that's like an AM radio thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
In other words, I might get a message, Reverend Elliott at Eagle, do you have a message from, and so forth.
Mm.
And then we would, that was all we could do. I mean, no way of replying to that. Then when I taught school at Eagle, the village that got destroyed by ice back in 58, and we had the school radio, and so I could reply then and send messages back to Fairbanks.
You taught school as part of your duties as a priest?
Well, what happened was the school teacher at the village of Eagle suddenly resigned in December, and so the Bureau of Indian Affairs asked me if I would just fill in until May, from January to May, because otherwise the children would have lost all that the time that
right.
they put in. So I did, and it was a wonderful experience
right.
at Eagle. And we were the only building that had electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because we had a generator. And so, of course, this is the days before TV and all the rest of it, even if they'd had electricity. And so the children would come at night. There were 17 with grades 1 through 7, and I was the teacher. It was the easiest thing I've ever done. Those children wanted to learn. The worst punishment I could give would be to say, you're going home, you've just misbehaved.
Huh.
Oh no, I'll be good, let me stay.
That's great.
And they would come back at night to read because we had the electricity.
Oh, they didn't have electricity at home?
None in the villages at all, no.
Yeah.
In fact, in 53 when I was at Eagle, I was in the town of Eagle in 53, and we had no electricity, and even in the church we had to use gas lamps.
Mm-hmm.
And my famous story about 53 is that I would walk 3 miles to the village every Sunday morning and have a service, and then come back and have a service in the evening in the town. And one day it was 60 below.
Mm.
And so I walked up to the village. And when I got there, everyone said, wait a minute, we didn't think you were coming. So we haven't lit a fire in the church. Well, of course, there was nothing to freeze, no pipes or anything. Mm-hmm. It was 60 below in the church.
Oh, geez.
I said, well, I'm here. So we had a service.
Oh.
I don't know if that's a Guinness Book of Records or not.
That has got to be. All I can say is you must be a very good preacher if people hung around.
It was
that.
A short sermon.
Yeah.
Very brief.
So you must have made some relationships and some friendships with folks back then that are still going all
yes,
these
that's
years
right.
later.
Yes, yes.
And probably with the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren.
You're right. That's it. Yes, yes. The some of the children now grown from Eagle especially introduced me to their grandchildren.
Hmm. That's great. So you came back to Anchorage, and you were the rector at All Saints for many, many years.
Well, in 58, I went to Ketchikan. Mm-hmm. Right after we finished the school closed in Fairbanks, we spent the summer up around Fairbanks, still flying. And then in the fall, we went to Ketchikan. And then in 62, I came from Ketchikan to All Saints Church, Anchorage. And then I retired in 1990.
No, and when you, and All Saints, if people don't know, is that little church which is now surrounded by huge office buildings, but at that time was kind of a residential little area downtown.
It was, even during the earthquake, 64, there were only small houses around, mm-hmm. fortunately. But no, the in 64, I think the biggest building downtown was, in addition to, it was the Hilton, the L Street Apartments, Inlet Towers, and Penny's probably were the biggest buildings.
Right. No. And so you were essentially a neighborhood congregation, I assume, whereas now it would be much kind of like an urban center area.
Yes, well.
It changed during those years, though.
It has. I mean, when I first saw Anchorage in 52, it had one paved street. Fourth mm-hmm. Avenue was paved, I think, from K maybe to the cemetery. Ninth Avenue was the firebreak between the town and the homesteads, and all the streets were dirt and gravel. And in fact, one man drove me way out to a place in the woods, and he said, we're selling lots out here, and I forget how much it was, but it wasn't very much, except it was much compared to what the cost is today. And I thought, who in the world's going to live here? Turning it by the sea now.
would have been a good investment, but priests don't make that much money anyway.
That's right, right? That's right. Well, another thing too, even in when we came here in 62, we would drive out and we'd see signs, you know, for sale, for sale. Who in the world's going to come out here? That's where the Diamond Center is.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
So the growth was just explosive.
That's right.
It just really
I think fast. Probably right after the earthquake we mm-hmm. began to explode. And I don't know what to attribute that to, except that maybe people seeing Anchorage on the TVs and all that of the earthquake realized we did not live in igloos and snow houses and we weren't covered with snow.
Right.
You know, and so wait a minute, let's look into this place. Uh-huh. I don't know. I have to tell tourists, there's not one city, town, or village in Alaska that has snow on the ground all year round.
Yeah.
And that's true. There isn't.
Now, you've been retired now for 22 years.
Yeah, I retired in 1990.
But you're busier than a lot of working people I know, at least with the amount of chaplain work you do at Providence Hospital and at the Native Hospital. And tell me about your daily schedule and work that you do with folks.
It's not much of a daily schedule. I do it when I want to, but I do visit Providence probably almost once a day. And if I know there are patients there, it may be more. Same way with the Native Hospital. Rarely to Elmendorf because I have to know who's there, and same with regional. But then I'm on the municipality commissions of Sister City Commission and the Housing and Neighborhood Development Commission. And that's not too busy, but it's enough. And
I'm willing to bet you're in the higher percentages of busyness for 93-year-olds. So.
Well, I don't know. As I said, when you retire, you quit one job and are handed 14.
Right, if you're willing to take them.
That's right.
So when you're working at the hospital and being a chaplain, what sort of thing are you doing? How are you helping people out?
I don't know. I mean, I really can't say if I'm helping anyone out, except that I do call on them, and that frequently I'll be stopped by someone in the hospital who doesn't even know me and say, will you go and see such and such a patient mm-hmm. and so forth. That happened just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to do it. Now, I have to emphasize, I'm not an official chaplain of the hospital. They have their own pastoral mm-hmm. chaplains. I do have the flash card that I can get into any of the units. And so forth, like nurses can, but I'm on my own as far as right. pastoral care. I'm sort of listed as a pastoral care, but I'm not on that staff. I have to make that clear.
All right. Well, you say you don't know if you're helping, but I remember when you came to see my mother about a year ago, and I can tell you that you helped a lot, that there was a real sense of peace and greater confidence in the room after you'd been there and said communion.
Thank you.
Is that, you're doing little services for people at their bedside, or mm-hmm. listening to their concerns, talking to them?
No, I have to say that if you really want to know, one of my best experiences was at Eagle in 1953. And I'm talking about the town of Eagle. That's the place that I did say I had that 60 below walk up to the village, but there were 17 adults and no children. And so it's an organized community in our town. And so we had to have a government. So we did, we had a mayor. And they appointed me town clerk, town assessor, and town attorney. Well, I'm not an attorney. I don't know a blessed thing about assessing anybody, but I could happily send out the tax forms as clerk. And one of the great things about Eagle is that they have a pinochle was the standard game. And so if we had a meeting of the city council, which consisted of four of us, the mayor would say, any business? Well, yes, the mail plane's due in tomorrow. Do anyone plow the field? I'll do it. Okay, get out the cards. Pinochle.
Thanks. This has been really, really enjoyable. Thanks so much for being with us today.
I'm happy to be with you. I hope it's all right.
Oh, it's great. My guest today on 101 has been the Reverend Norm Elliott. My name is Charles Wolforth. Join us again next week.
One-on-One is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated. John LaFournaise directs and edits the show. Pat Yak is the producer. Camera operators are Travis Gilmore and Josh Edge. Audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. One-on-One is recorded at Pilates Brothers Cafe at JL Tower. You can watch One-on-One Sunday nights at 6:30 p.m. and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on KAKM Channel 7 TV, or listen Thursdays at 1 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage. Tune in next week for One-on-One when Charles Wolforth interviews creator of Tundra comic strip, Chad Carpenter. This is KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.